This is Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. The United States Supreme Court announced yesterday that it's going to take on for the first time in three decades the issue of the federal communications regulation of broadcast decency, the FCC setting standards for what's appropriate in the way of words that are aired on broadcast television and radio. This case results from a fine that was leveled on Fox Broadcasting after a couple of uses of the F word by musicians at the Billboard Music Awards, those awards being broadcast live on Fox. ABC, CBS, and NBC joined with Fox's challenge of the policy that was announced about 4 years ago. What resulted was a second Circuit Court of Appeals ruling, which favored the networks and said the FCC went too far in its regulations on fleeting expletives, as they've been dubbed. Now the U.S. Supreme Court says that it wants to hear the case and will do so later this year. With us is Director of the Stanford Constitutional Law Center at Stanford University, Derek Schaffer. Thank you, sir, for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's talk first of all about the significance of this. 30 years is a long time for the Supreme Court to have been on the sidelines for this debate. The fact that the High Court is willing to take this on, does that in any way indicate that it might be more likely to reverse the appellate court ruling than not?
That's generally the thinking, Larry. When the Supreme Court grants cert in a case like this where there's no division between the courts of appeals, usually one would think that it's doing so to make a particular statement contrary to what the Court of Appeals has said. This is a little bit of a different case. One thing I need to point out at the outset is, as you did, is although it's been 30 years since the Supreme Court revisited the question of what speech the FCC can regulate, it was only 4 years ago that the FCC arrived at the position at issue. For, you know, nearly three decades prior to then, the FCC's position had been that use of a quote-unquote fleeting expletive, where it was just an ostensibly inadvertent use of an obscenity as part of a live broadcast, for instance, that would not give rise to sanctions. And then 4 years ago, after Bono blurted out the F word during an acceptance speech, the FCC changed its position so that now, in this case, it argued to the Second Circuit that it can indeed argue, regulate and sanction fleeting expletives. So that's a change in position that's new, or a relatively recent vintage, and the Supreme Court may want to say something about it. We don't really know. It does seem like that much more significant a case now that the Supreme Court has granted review. The way the Second Amendment Court, rather the Second Circuit Court of Appeals decided this, it had said this was not a First Amendment case. It was just a case where the agency had changed its position without adequately explaining itself.
Okay, so that it needed to give a rationale for doing so and changing with past practice.
A better rationale, but usually the Supreme Court wouldn't weigh in to speak to just that question of administrative law because no one really, that's not a very controversial or novel proposition that the agency does need to explain itself if it changes position.
And from a constitutional perspective, what's at issue here? Is it the regulatory authority of the FCC, or how is this rooted in an interpretation of the Constitution?
That's a great question. The answer is, according to the Second Circuit, this wasn't really a constitutional case. It wasn't a First Amendment case because the court didn't need to go that far. It just looked at the agency's rationale and said, according to well-settled statutory authorities and the way that agencies operate, you need to do a better job, FCC, in order to change your position, and we, the Second Circuit, aren't going to get to any constitutional question. We're not going to look at the First Amendment question, although we think you'd have a tough time, FCC, justifying your position as one that comports with the First Amendment. But as I said, the fact that the Supreme Court is granting review leads some of us to suspect that it may want to say something constitutional. It may want to speak to whether the FCC can, in fact, take this position under the First Amendment or whether its position would necessarily violate the First Amendment.
We're speaking with the director of the Constitutional Law Center at Stanford University, Derek Schaffer, with us on Air Talk. Yesterday, the nation's high court announcing that it will hear arguments later this year on a case involving the major American television networks and the Federal Communications Commission. Now, in the case of news programming, live news, a fleeting expletive there is not subject subject to FCC action, although what sort of complicates that, wasn't there some interview on Good Morning America where a guest made some sort of a comment that involved an expletive and the FCC initially fined ABC? I thought there was a case like that, which had me scratching my head because I thought on news programs this was not an issue.
Well, I'd love to say that you're totally safe, Larry, but unfortunately you're not. We all need to watch ourselves on this program and otherwise, because it's more complicated than that. The FCC says it looks at the whole context of the remark, and it certainly takes into account that something's on a news program, and that may make a difference. That may be enough to keep someone on a news program safe, but it's not absolutely clear that it will. And you're absolutely right. In one instance, in one of the instances that was at issue before the FCC, it was a survivor contestant who was being interviewed on the CBS morning show.
CBS, okay.
And I think did, you know, call someone else, used the S word in a live interview. And initially, the FCC said that that would give rise to a sanction, and it then reversed itself. While the case was pending before the Second Circuit, and did say the fact that it was on a news program was enough to tilt against the sanctions there.
Is there any issue here about using a delay? Because if a program is live, I mean, you can argue that from the viewer standpoint, there's a benefit to being able to see something as it's happening, as opposed to on a 20-second delay or whatever would assure that some producer assigned to sit there to look for any objectionable words, you know, could bleep them out before they're actually coming out of someone's television or radio. And does this become a value at all in this debate?
Yeah, I mean, well, one thing to speak to is live broadcast, and some of us certainly place a value on live broadcast.
Yeah, I sure do.
That what we're
yeah.
hearing and listening to really is happening live, as opposed to on delay, especially in today's world where news might otherwise reach you via the internet or via the radio or some other broadcast in a way that's not live or that is live, and your broadcast is being delayed. You might really suffer the sense of live surprise and enjoyment of whatever it is that's transpiring. But the other reality here is you have thousands of hours of live broadcasts that are going on, and the cost and the logistical difficulty of getting every single one of those on loop delay and having a human screener who can bleep things out, it's prohibitive. You would lose a lot of that live broadcast, at least according to the networks. I don't represent the networks, but I believe them when they say that, and they've certainly said that in this case. But the other thing is there are discussions. There's footage of 9/11. There are the Watergate tapes. There's discussion of this case, and there are, in fact, Supreme Court decisions where there are expletives that appear in a fleeting fashion, and there's nothing that you can do without compromising the content of that in order to get rid of those fleeting expletives so as to remain safe from these FCC sanctions, if indeed the FCC does claim and assert this authority.
We're speaking with Derek Schaffer, director of the Stanford Constitutional Law Center. Now, the other side of this issue is that these live programs are often on during hours where children are watching television. And at what level should children be protected from language that most of us would consider highly offensive? To provide that perspective, as director of public policy for the Parents Television Council, a nonprofit advocacy organization or focusing on making programming more family-friendly, Dan Isett. Mr. Isett, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Well, please share with us that perspective about, as you see it, the importance of broadcast television and radio, being aware that it's on in a family context.
Well, I think there's something that's been sort of lost in this entire discussion so far, and that is the simple fact that broadcasters only have a license to use the publicly owned airwaves in the public convenience and in the public interest. And the Supreme Court has already ruled that it is in the public interest, it is a compelling government interest, in fact, to protect children from indecent programming at the times when they're most likely to be in the audience. The Supreme Court ruled on this 30 years ago, and all it simply said was that if you're going to air things that are indecent, and then define that as things that are patently offensive, sexual, or excretory content, put that on after 10 o'clock when the kids go to bed. What's really at issue here is the broadcast networks are making the assertion that they have a quote-unquote right to air essentially unlimited profanity at any time of day, no matter who's in the audience. And that's what's really at stake here, and that's why there's been so much controversy about the Second Circuit decision that you mentioned from last year. You know, that case turned on the fact that these instances of profanity were quote-unquote fleeting, and that quote-unquote fleeting expletives should be okay, and the F and the S word in particular should be okay prior to 10 o'clock, prior to that Supreme Court established safe harbor time. The major flaw in that argument is the fact that by its very nature, profanity is fleeting. All profanity is fleeting unless you may be on a naval vessel or something like that. So the law shouldn't be tripped on, well, you have to drop 20 F-bombs before we're going to have a problem with this. One is enough when you're talking about that time when millions of children are
being. I can certainly imagine, though, Mr. Isett, where there'd be reality programming where, you know, if people talk as they do, unfortunately, on the street, you would be hearing strings of expletives. Reality version of, you know, many of the scripted shows that we see.
The standard that the Supreme Court established was a contemporary community standard for the broadcast medium. It's not a contemporary community standard for down the street. It's not a contemporary community standard for a taxi stand. It's the community standard for the broadcast medium. And traditionally and time-honored, that standard has been different and has been higher.
Well,
and that's what's really at stake.
All right. Yes, Mr. Schaffer.
Yeah, well, if I could just speak to the Supreme Court's word on this subject, and it's a little bit more of a complicated picture and I think a different picture than has been painted. Basically, the standard here, it's not the obscenity standard. It doesn't vary according to localities, at least not necessarily the way that was just articulated. But 30 years ago, when the Supreme Court spoke to this and said the FTC could sanction for use of expletives, the instance there was a 2 p.m. broadcast with George Carlin's monologue about the so-called filthy words. It was called the Filthy Words Monologue. It was 12 minutes of ceaseless expletives designedly used in what Justice Powell's concurrence called shock treatment, verbal shock treatment. And so the Supreme Court there was very narrowly divided. It was a 5-4 decision that said, given that it was a 2 p.m. broadcast, given the nature of it, that it was just rife with expletives, that was something the FCC could sanction, but it was very qualified. It specifically reserved judgment on whether the FCC could likewise regulate the use of the fleeting expletive. So it's not as if the Supreme Court 30 years ago said the FCC could do what it's doing now.
Well, and that wasn't a live broadcast either. That was a recording of George Carlin's routine, right?
That is exactly right.
So there was a programming decision involved. Mr. Isett?
Well, the issue here is not simply about live programming. There have been scripted instances of profanity like this. They're not at issue in this particular case. But the issue here is not simply accidental live broadcasts of the occasional F-word or things like that. What's at stake here is what these standards are going to be. And the Supreme Court was very clear. I would disagree with the learned professor on this. But the Supreme Court was clear that the FCC had the ability to make rules such as this. And it bears mentioning that the Congress of the United States, less than 2 years ago, raised the fines significantly for violation of federal broadcast decency law in an overwhelming bipartisan vote. So there's no question that the American people are incensed about this. There's no question that the American people want something done about this. I think it's unfortunate that the broadcast networks have seen fit to assert this quote-unquote right to air language like this. If you're going to do that, wait till after 10 o'clock.
All right, we'll continue our conversation on the U.S. Supreme Court taking up this issue of fleeting obscenities on broadcast TV and radio. This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by Dance at the Music Center, presenting American Ballet Theater, performing the world's most beloved ballet, Swan Lake, the romantic tale of love, betrayal, and forgiveness, a stunning production set to Tchaikovsky's glorious score. 5 performances only, March 27th through the 30th at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion. Information at musiccenter.org, tickets at ticketmaster.com. Well, as expected, the Federal Reserve has cut a key interest rate by 0.75%. The rate cut is in response to the struggling economy and credit markets. L.A. residents who don't want to pay more for water and power can speak out tonight. The city will hold a public hearing a week before the council takes up the proposal. KPCC's Cheryl Duvall has more.
Water and power officials told the L.A. City Council committees that it's past time to raise rates. The public utility maintains that L.A. electricity users haven't paid more per kilowatt hour in 15 years. Some of the equipment that moves water and electricity through the city is 40 to 70 years old, department officials said, and they predicted power outages and water quality warnings if the higher rates don't go through. Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa is supporting the push for that increase. Ratepayers who don't agree will have opportunities to say so, starting tonight at 7. That's when the Department of Water and Power's general manager plans to attend a public hearing at Westminster Elementary School in Venice. Cheryl Duvall, 89.3 KPCC.
Many of Saudi Arabia's homegrown Muslim extremists are behind bars. Their government is trying to re-educate some of the jihadists. It's teaching them a moderate interpretation of Islam and encouraging tolerance of non-Muslims before allowing them back on the street. Rehabilitating Saudi radicals on the world today at noon here on 89.3 KPCC. In Hollywood, the 101 South, slow right now from Highland to the 10. It's 11:21.
This is Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're discussing the U.S. Supreme Court's announcement yesterday that later this year it will hear arguments regarding the Federal Communication Commission's authority to regulate so-called fleeting obscenities on television, particularly live broadcasts, where the networks involved and the individual local stations had no idea that such obscenities would be making their way to viewers or listeners. I'd love to hear from you. What do you think is an appropriate standard? How do you balance this issue over what may be the exposure of children to obscene words or to words that most of us would find offensive for children to be exposed to versus the efforts of the broadcast industry to bring live programming into people's homes where such statements or words can be used? We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. What do you think is the best possible decision for the U.S. Supreme Court to make in a case like this? Our guests are Dan Isett, Director of Public Policy for the Parents Television Council, and Derek Schaffer, Director of Stanford University's Constitutional Law Center. You were saying, Mr. Isett, as I recall, that this doesn't necessarily apply just to live programming, but doesn't the FCC have a right to say of a scripted program that there is an obligation on the part of the networks not to allow obscene words to go out over the air during hours where children might be watching?
No, let's be very clear about this. The responsibility of broadcasters as licensees of the publicly owned airwaves is to be responsible with regards to this, is to uphold their public interest requirements. And one of those public interest requirements that your station abides by and every other licensee abides by is a commitment to follow federal broadcast decency law. And all it simply says is that content such as this cannot be aired until after 10 o'clock. It's really just that simple. So I think that's what's really at issue in this entire debate. We keep going back to these live instances. This isn't simply about live programming. The Second Circuit decision turned on the fact that the content was fleeting. It didn't define what fleeting meant. So what it said was that if you only drop one or two or maybe five F-bombs in a program, then that's okay because it's fleeting. To me, that doesn't make any sense because, like I said before, that type of content by its very nature is fleeting. And that's really what's at issue in this entire discussion.
Professor Schaffer, does live versus tape matter? Because it seems to me there's a huge difference.
Well, let's put it this way. This is a specific case that involves some specific instances of sanctions, and those sanctions were imposed for live broadcasts where it was not scripted. And so for the broadcasters here to win on these specific facts, their argument does not need to go as far as Mr. Isett seems to think that it might. I think the broadcasters are making quite a limited argument. I might think the First Amendment goes further, but in order for them to win this case, what matters is that their live broadcasts, which were unscripted, where the obscenities were fleeting, are not subject to sanction, as the FCC has sought to sanction it. That's one quick point that I'd like to make. The other point is, and this should matter to your listeners out there, we could not be having this conversation, or we'd have to have a very different conversation if we all felt that your station stood to be sanctioned monetarily to the tune of very large sanctions and perhaps have its license revoked simply because one of us, in talking about the specifics of this case, happened to use an obscenity. I would like to think that this is a valuable conversation, one that all of us having it value and one that your listeners out there value. And if that's true, I think it just shows the First Amendment ramifications and the harm that would be done if the FCC is indeed entitled to claim this authority. And the last point is, I don't think that there's much of a difference between us as far as what ought to be done to protect children. Children ought to be protected the way that their parents see fit. And one of the things that Congress has done is mandate that all televisions have V-chips put in them so that programming can be screened out based upon how it is graded for content, basically the ratings assigned to particular content. And that gives parents the authority that they ought to have to decide that certain programming is not going to come into the house because they don't want it for their children. That's a choice that they should be making, not the government making for them.
But let's be realistic. I mean, the percentage of parents that actually use the rating system and activate their V-chip to screen according to ratings, I mean, that's going to be the same subset of parents who are very responsible about controlling what their kids watch on television anyway. And as we well know, there are a lot of dud parents who don't pay much attention to what their kids are doing and are pretty missing in action. So is there a societal obligation to help protect kids from stuff that's on during those hours when their parents are, you know, busy being preoccupied with their own thing?
Well, if there is, that obligation is going to go very, very far indeed for the reasons you've suggested. This is something that children may overhear on the sidewalk. They may find it on the internet where the Supreme Court has squarely held that this is protected. They may pick it up reading a book. They might pick a lot of this up reading Hemingway or Catcher in the Rye or going to see the Vagina Monologue. So it's out there, and the question is there some special warrant for government to be regulating this speech so that it never even gets articulated in the first instance in this context? And the answer to that is no, because in this context, there's actually a relatively reliable way through which parents who care about this can block it. But I think the parents who don't care about this are not likely to be keeping their children free of any expletives they may catch out there in the world.
How do special kinds of programs factor into this? The often cited over-the-air broadcasts of Saving Private Ryan and all the, you know, soldier expletives that are in that film, because I know networks have provided unedited copies of that film and have put that up on their network satellites for airing on local stations, and it hasn't been in, you know, it's been in that family period of time prior to 10 o'clock that it's aired. So what's the FCC's view been on that?
The FCC has said that is not going to be sanctioned because that is an inherent part of the artistic merit of that. And so it's made this the very sort of decision that government should not be in the business of making, saying that the same expletives, in fact, when more frequently used over the course of hours of programming is Saving Private Ryan, that can go out there into the home. That's okay for children. But if it's said in passing in the course of a live acceptance speech, then that will give rise to sanctions and perhaps revocation of a license. And it's really making decisions that seem quite suspect in terms of discrimination based upon the content of particular speech or the viewpoint associated with that speech, but it's certainly very difficult, if not impossible, for a broadcaster out there to know what's safe and what isn't.
Mr. Isett, do you think that is a consistent application of the obscenity rules by the agency?
Well, it's difficult to know where to start about this. The professor has thrown out so many red herrings that I could fish all day. The inherent problem with the V-chip and cable box parental controls is that the ratings themselves determine whether or not the V-chip and the parental controls work. And those ratings are given to that content by the people who produce the content in the first place. And consequently, they have an inherent conflict of interest when it comes to rating their programming appropriately. That's a completely different discussion. But with the specifics of these two cases, and when you're talking about fleeting expletives in particular, quote-unquote fleeting, are we going to rate everything that's live programming with the TVMA so as to protect children from them if we're going to say that the V-chip is the solution to this? On these two particular shows, they were not rated appropriately to give parents a warning that there was going to be language like this. So the V-chip would not have helped a single parent or a single child be protected from this content in this particular instance. So, with the case of Saving Private Ryan, I think that's a different discussion. Again, the test is an in-context test. In that context, the FCC, I think, appropriately made a determination that this wasn't a set of indecency, but somewhere along the way. We as a society should be able to differentiate between Nicole Richie dropping an F-bomb in an award show and something like Saving Private Ryan, and that's what this whole discussion is about.
Well, so is it your contention then that the network should assume, because it's the Billboard Music Awards and because fair number of musicians who might be honored may not be mature enough to be able to handle talking live on TV and control their language, that then the network, you know, shouldn't show it or delay it till 10 o'clock?
What
should they do?
Consistently here hear from the networks is that, gosh, we just had no idea that so-and-so would say something like this on our live air. And how many times does this have to happen before we start questioning that explanation?
It's just, pretty uncommon,
though. The past month, there's been a use of the C-word, of all things, on the Today Show, and F-bomb on Good Morning America. You know, in addition to these award show things that you've mentioned in the past, at what point do we have to say, you know, if we're going to interview a celebrity in particular on live air, we should take some type of precaution there. I don't think that's too much to ask.
Okay. I mean, it seems to me, given the, you know, thousands and thousands of hours of live programming, that it is pretty rare for this to happen. Don't you think, Mr. Isett, or not? You see it as increasingly common?
There's no question that it's increasingly common. And the bottom line of the discussion is that you hold a license to use the publicly owned airwaves. If you're going to do that, you must be responsible with your use of the public airwaves.
Let's take a listener call. Bill and Dana Point, welcome to Air Talk.
Hello, oh, good afternoon.
Hi.
Hey, a couple of points there. One of them is that when we have live shows, there's a huge difference between something which is historic and something which seems to be going out on a live feed, whether it's the Today Show or some kind of reality show. If they're going to show Barack Obama's speech this morning live, I think that there's a lot of value in doing that. But if we have one more reality show, I don't care that it doesn't have a 20-second delay.
Okay. All right. So you think it's not too much of a burden to put on broadcasters to have those kinds of delay systems in place for entertainment-oriented live programming?
Not at all.
Okay.
No problem in any way. And in addition to that, the comments about the V-chip, I'm a parent of three kids from 7 to 12, and the V-chip is not really helpful or usable in the form that Congress mandated it. They had an opportunity to make something that was far more tailorable and usable by parents, and they buckled under to broadcaster pressure and put out what we have today. That we could have shifted the burden from the broadcasters editing themselves onto parents to make settings for their kids. And all we would have needed to do is to take the four dimensions that they have in the rating system and put them out as a live stream and let you set your own level at home on your own TV.
Okay.
So that if, you know, so if you like, you know, only level one of sex and level eight of violence, you can pick that. But they declined to do that.
Bill, I appreciate your call. Thanks very much. And I'm sorry we only have time for one more call before we need to conclude our conversation. It's from Bill driving on the San Diego freeway. You're on Air Talk.
Hi, thanks very much. It's Manchester and Los Angeles.
Okay.
You know, I'm not a content person in terms of telling what content, but I think if the Supreme Court could do as they did with libel for print media, well, for all media, print media, they gave criteria by which the standard of what you must do, if the Supreme Court could tell a Howard Stern what levels of criteria they have to meet so that they know that they have crossed a line, or my thinking, set a pattern and a tone, not a content ding, but if they're to give true meaning, that to me would be what I would hope the Supreme Court would do.
You want real specificity, and Howard Stern's not a good example because he's now on satellite radio, but I get your point that the previous technology employed by Howard Stern's show when it was on FM. Derek Schaffer, quick comment on that. Is it likely the High Court would give such a level of specificity?
I don't think so. It's quite unique to basically the libel standard, as Bill was suggesting, that there's really a standard of fault. It's not just a question of whether you make a false statement. It's a question of whether it's knowingly false or you've made it with actual malice. I don't expect the Supreme Court's going to go in that direction here. One quick thing I'd point out, a context we haven't talked about, is live sporting events. It has been the case that, for instance, when the U.S. women were playing China in the 2004 Olympics, someone missed a shot and used an expletive, and that's given rise to an FCC investigation. So when we talk about thousands of hours of TV footage that would need to be put on delay, all live sporting events would potentially fall in that category, and that's a very, very difficult thing, as I understand it, for the broadcast.
Yeah, I've heard that a few times on Laker broadcasts here in Los Angeles with players.
It happens.
Yeah. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Really appreciate you sharing your perspectives on this. Derek Schaffer of the Stanford Constitutional Law Center that he directs, and Dan Isett of the Parents Television Council. He's Director of Public Policy. policy there. This is Air Talk on KPCC.
89.3 KPCC is now broadcasting in HD digital stereo. With a new HD radio receiver, you can listen to our main service and two alternative channels, BBC Mundo, the Spanish language news service of the BBC, and The Current, adult alternative music from Minnesota Public Radio. For more information on HD radio, please visit kpcc.org.
This is Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Novelist John Retchie is revered for his writings going back to the early 1960s, in which the gay American underground was explored. He used a fictional protagonist, but based on his experiences as a street hustler, to give a wider America a kind of window into the life that gay men had to lead at that time in the country, what with police activities and raids and difficulty with so many gay men being able to even accept themselves for who they were. His books gave a real kind of understanding to the larger American public about those challenges and that culture. John Retchie's book, City of Night, is considered a modern classic. He's also written the highly regarded books Numbers, Body and Souls, The Miraculous Day of Amalia Gomez, and The Sexual Outlaw. Now his latest work is not fiction. It's a memoir which takes us back to his early years growing up in El Paso as a Mexican-American in a mixed-ethnicity family and looking for his identity racially, ethnically, and sexually. The book is titled About My Life and the Kept Woman, a memoir, John Retchie. John, great to have you with us again on Air Talk. It's been years, and appreciate your joining us. Well, let's talk about those early years. What was your boyhood like?
I guess, in one word, largely unhappy. But I suppose in the matter of racial identity, I was born in El Paso, and at that time, believe it or not, it's difficult to believe now, but the antipathy against Mexicans was quite as real as against black people. There were hardly any black people in El Paso, but there was segregation. Some of the theaters, not in El Paso, but in the fringes of smaller towns, some of the theaters would have signs that would say the white people to the right, Spics to the left, and they would have only one day when Mexicans were allowed. Some of the restaurants, the smaller places, segregated, and even counters like, for example, Newberry's, they tended to shove the Mexican people to the side.
Which is so hard to believe because El Paso is such a Latino town today. I assume
Mexican.
The city council is all Mexican-American, and this is just so hard to imagine.
It was another world, Larry. It was entirely another world. And so the pressures were enormous. I got it, in, as I say, both ways, because people didn't think that I was Mexican. I didn't look like what they expected a Mexican to look like. So I felt an outsider from both my both Hispanics, Latinos, whatever, but also from the white people who would often be talking nastily about me.
As we continue, we'll talk about this sense of finding one's identity and the alienation that you experienced as a gay man and as a Mexican-American growing up and moving about the United States from that base in El Paso, making his way west. This is Air Talk on KPCC.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by City of Hope, helping to lead the way in less invasive colon cancer surgery using the Da Vinci robotic system. Guided by specially trained surgeons, Da Vinci helps remove tumors precisely for faster recovery. Most patients return home in days. If you have colon cancer, you can call 800-826-HOPE, or you can ask your doctor for a referral. City of Hope, science saving lives.
Are you ready for a giveaway? We have one for you right now, a pair of tickets to see Culture Clash in America at the South Coast Repertory, now through April 6th. The Latino Comedy Troupe presents the city-specific shows ranging from San Francisco and the Big Apple to Little Cuba. Now they've added Orange County to the mix. Their explosion of ideas bursts forth in every direction, with scenes that are political, social, satirical, ethnic, fearless, and hysterical. Variety is called Culture Clash Comic Masters. Tickets available at scr.org, and we'll take the third caller at 626-585-7893. LA County officials today will unveil wanted posters in an effort to locate the 10 most egregious child support payment evaders. An aide to Supervisor Don Canabi says the 10 owe more than $2 million in unpaid child support for 17 children. Barack Obama is making it clear that he rejects much of what his longtime pastor has said about issues ranging from the 9/11 attacks to black-white relations. But Obama says he can't disown the Reverend Jeremiah Wright any more than he could disown his white grandmother, who's also made statements that Obama says made him cringe. We'll be carrying Obama's speech in its entirety at 7 tonight here on KPCC. Another beautiful day. Highs will be in the low 70s. A little windy, a few degrees cooler tomorrow, but continued sunny. In Mid-City, the 10 West slow and go from Normandy to Overland. It's 11:41.
This is Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle with novelist John Retchie, but it's not a work of fiction we're talking about on this edition of Air Talk. It's his new memoir, About My Life and the Kept Woman. We're going to get to who that kept woman was momentarily and what she represents in the structure of this book and in his boyhood experiences. But I want to put out the call to you, particularly if you're a gay man who's read John Retchie's writing over the years. I'd love to hear your thoughts about his work. We're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. You know, when City of Night was published in 63, was it? This was a very controversial book, hailed by some for the kind of inside and window into the gay underground in America then. I don't even know if the term gay was being used. I mean, this is pre-Christopher Street and Stonewall. But also criticized by others. There were those who felt that it portrayed gay men as just essentially promiscuous, and they were critical of the way that that world was depicted in the book. But it's the world that John Retchie knew, and he was telling his story through a fictionalized protagonist. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on what his work has meant to you. 866-893-KPCC. So John, let's get back to this issue of identity, because to me it's really central in this memoir.
It is.
And so you're feeling alienated as a Mexican American. You write of even denying your own ethnicity and passing for Euro-American.
I never denied it. I just let it be. I never proclaimed it.
You passed.
I passed. And it was easy to. And, you know, as a kid, you've got enough things coming at you. I thought, why the hell do I have to then put up with discrimination and that sort of thing if I don't have to? I never claimed to be other than what I was, but I didn't proclaim it. I let it slide by until much later when, these things do change.
Now, in terms of accepting yourself as a gay man, you wrote about this world of gay hustling where there's this kind of denial, for the most part, that the men that do it are gay. It's seen as economic necessity, and there's certain rules about how it's conducted and even how one talks about sexuality between men.
Oh, sure. But please remember that in City of Night, I was depicting a segment of a world. It's as if, you know, in broader terms, you're going to talk about people who live in Pasadena and congregate once a week or something like that. People expect that if you're writing about a world that's not that well known, that it represents the whole world. I never intended that. It was a small segment of gay life that I wrote about, the segment that I knew. And I never anticipated writing about it, incidentally.
More than you wrote a book about the gay men who were suffering in heterosexual marriages.
That's right. That I leave up to the men who are suffering in heterosexual marriages, and that will be, their part to tell. The discrimination that existed against homosexuals, there was no word such as gay, and now the word queer has come into the fore, which I detest.
Really?
Yeah. I won't ever use queer in reference to myself or to any other homosexual.
So you don't like the idea of sort of appropriating that language, taking the slur and turning around saying, I'm different, I'm part of what is a minority, and it's okay, and taking that back on, that doesn't work for you?
No, it doesn't, Larry. I'll tell you why. Because men of my generation heard that word as something very hateful that very often preceded violence, even murder. And so to take that word, in a sense, to honor it as part of our identity, to me, is not only to diffuse it, but to accept it. And I detest that word. Plus, it creates a separation between men of my generation and a newer generation, as if now they belong entirely to somewhere else without realizing.
So you feel there's a chasm created. Do you sense that generation gap among gay men?
I don't travel now in groups where I would feel it myself, and as a writer, I would not feel it. But there has always been a separation in the gay world. I mean, you know, you can hear denials and say that's not true, but it is true. There has always been a demarcation between younger homosexuals and older homosexuals. That has existed and exists now.
How much of that is aesthetic, or, I mean, a rejection among younger gay men of simple physical aging in older men, and how much of it is not feeling in any way tethered to the kind of bigotry, the extent that men of your age experienced?
I don't feel at all that it's the latter. It would be good to think so, really. It really is the former. Again, the sort of thing that should not be said and that I get criticized for saying. There is a great discrimination because the homosexual arena is basically sexual. And again, troublesome to say that. It is. The separation between young and old has always existed. There were places earlier, and there still are, that will not admit anybody over a certain age. The signs a couple of decades back were actually posted in some clubs. No trolls, oldies, or somebody else. And there would be people at the gate filtering, very much like a velvet rope, but not a velvet rope. So that feeling of alienation is, I'm sorry to say, built into the gay world. I don't know how it would be changed.
We have a listener called in, didn't want to come on the air, but his name is Fred from Los Angeles. He's a gay man who read City of Night. He said it made him feel worse about himself, instilled a sense of doom in him about being gay. And he wants to know if sex for you has been an issue of guilt, if that relates to Catholic background in you, or if that rings true for you at all.
For very long, I suppose it was inescapable, whether we recognized it or not. You know, it was a time when religion was calling us sinners, psychiatry was calling us sick, religion was calling us sinful. So try to emerge out of that unscathed. But very early on, after the hustling years, or actually during the hustling years, I did not feel ashamed at all. I don't feel ashamed now. But I was dealing with the expectations that the outside world puts on us. To support a job, you must not be gay. During the 50s and 60s, 50s, McCarthy, there was a McCarthy era. And people don't know that McCarthy was also pushing homosexuals around.
Didn't he call them perverts? Or yes. I mean, this was his term for
gay perverts.
Men.
And then a lot occurred. People, that was when a large contingent of homosexuals fled to Los Angeles, ostensibly to be more liberal because of Hollywood. And what greeted us were street raids. People don't know that about. This is one thing that I decry about younger homosexuals. They don't know our history of oppression. They simply accept a climate of relative acceptance. It is not acceptance. That's a mythology. Look at just recently how many young gay men have been murdered by gay bashers. So how can you say that those were things of the past?
Well, you acknowledge it's much better today, though full acceptance has not arrived.
Much, much, much better, with new and ancient problems left unresolved.
One of the things I think of is that even in the entertainment industry, which we think of a bastion of progressive political and social views, and you think of all the leading men in Hollywood who today are gay and can't come out for fear and perhaps the actual fact that their careers would be destroyed.
You know, that is true, Larry. And there's a whole process of homosexuals thinking that people should be outed. I don't feel that. If somebody is harming us and is gay, as happens very, very often with politicians who are crying against perverts and themselves indulging, then they should be outed. But there are many realities still. And in Hollywood, as much as one might declaim the actors who do that, it is understood that if that happened, what's his name, Hugh... the English actor.
Hugh Grant?
Yeah, Hugh Grant came out, and you will not see him in a romantic role anymore. And his career will be affected entirely. So it is realistic. It's terrible.
I just want to clarify, realistic. You're not making a claim about his sexuality. You're just using him as an example.
Oh, yeah.
If someone like him who's been in all these leading men roles, that his career
out.
Wouldn't be viable.
He is out.
Hugh Grant?
Yeah. No.
Yeah, I think
sorry.
You've got
no,
someone
no, no.
else in
I'm
mind.
Sorry,
not Hugh
I'm
Grant.
Sorry. Back up. It's the other Englishman. What's his name? It's very much like that. No.
Okay. Well, we'll get to who the correct person is. I'm going to say you're going to say I am.
Sorry, Larry.
I thought
You'll
I liked
hear.
Women.
No.
Let's take a listener call. You want to put your headphones on. John Retchie with us, author of About My Life and The Kept Woman. Marshall in Hollywood, you're on Air Talk.
Hello, Larry. Hello, John.
Hi, Marshall.
John, I'm a 54-year-old gay male. That does not match my manhunt profile, but I grew up reading your books, and now I feel like I'm on the other side. I've come to Hollywood. I've had a chance to check out some of the things that you've written about cruising in the parks and that type of thing, and all I can say is the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Yeah, I feel that same way. I really feel the same way. And, you know, I'm not one for political correctness, whether it be in the Department of Gay Activities or whatever it is. I think that political correctness, including in gay terms, has put a stop to a lot of investigating of things that simply are and that one doesn't want to acknowledge. I see this happening all around. I see it among women. I see it among Hispanics. I see it among homosexuals, that certain problems are not to be talked about because they are deemed politically incorrect. And so they stay, they fester, and they continue.
Do you think that this is just a direct result of discrimination? So the fear is to talk about it is to in some way to buy into the stereotype and the criticism from the larger public?
I think so. I think so, Larry. Yes, indeed. And you use the word stereotype. To me, stereotypes, what we call stereotypes, are heroes and heroines. They're the ones who still defy the conventions, you see. And a lot of misconception occurs when political correctness means don't stray, become like everyone else, and then we're doing okay. And I say, absolutely not. That is destroying individuality. And among stereotypes, I champion stereotypes. I've written about stereotypes, and I think that they are continue to be heroic on the front lines of discrimination by saying, this is who I am, and I'm not changing in order to satisfy your blandness.
We appreciate your call, Marshall. We're at 866-893-KPCC. I do want to get to, by the way, the actor is Rupert Everett that you meant to talk about, who is out, a gay man, out in Hollywood.
Yeah, okay,
so,
fine.
The kept woman who you spied as a boy at your sister's wedding. She's marrying a man whose sister is at this wedding, and she has quite a story. And share with her what she symbolizes to you in the book.
Okay. This was a time of great discrimination and pseudo-morality in El Paso. And this particular woman, whom I call Marisa Guzman, I think, had become the mistress of one of Mexico's most powerful men. And she was not a trashy mistress. She was in the tradition of the great kept women. She had a mansion. She had her own chauffeur. But the thing in El Paso was that her father had cast her out and threatened to kill her if she ever came back. But she does come back for my sister's wedding. And I saw her only, my God, I don't think that it could have possibly been more than 3 minutes that I stared at her in fascination, where she had been isolated into a room at the wedding reception. And she was the most gorgeous creature I have ever seen. I don't think that anyone in my life will ever match that, whether today I would see her and I would say, you know, that's not so. At the time, I had never seen anyone like her. She was extravagant and beautiful, and she was notorious, and she was proud. And the fact that I saw her, challenging, even being murdered, being talked about, being ostracized, and looking so beautiful, stayed with me. And what stayed with me is the fact that, although I didn't remember it until much later, she was so proud of who she was.
Even though others reviled her.
Even though others reviled her, and sometimes enviously. Because a lot of revilement, if you will, is really envy. And you know, there is negative views on sexuality are actually based on envy. I think that one of the problems among, you know, that exists in the gay world is that we gay folk are notorious for liking abundant sexuality, which I think is good if one is very careful, of course, with all the realities of illness. And I think that some of it is really what I shall call penis envy of the homosexual who is indulging in sexuality without the kind of guilt that one is supposed to be feeling about that. I never felt guilt about the sex itself. It was the imposed dangers that I railed against.
And so your position is that gay men need to be less judgmental and more accepting of what are considered often to be stereotypes?
Yes. Absolutely, yes.
See that part of the picture for gay men?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, but also with some dignity. For example, I detest the gay parade.
Oh. Really?
Because it's a freak circus for heterosexuals to come and leer at us. So if you want to do that, let's do it on Halloween or New Year's Eve. But on Gay Pride, you know, that's what it becomes. Look at that one.
Gay business leader. I mean, it's not all drag queens in the Gay Pride parades,
right? No, it isn't. No, it's different. It is definitely not. But it's a performance for heterosexuals. It really is. And it sickens me.
John Retchie, thank you for being with us. Always good controversial conversation when you join us. Thanks.
My pleasure.
About My Life and the Kept Woman, a memoir, writer John Retchie. This is Air Talk. Have a wonderful day.